Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires.
Hey, podcast listeners. If you have enjoyed the leadership principles that Simon and his guests discuss in these shows, you should know that they're informed by what we teach high-level coaches, executives, and change agents in the Advanced Analytic Network Coach Training Course. Participants have been working directly with Simon for up to 4 hours a week, combining theory, life practice, reflection, and group discussion to solidify learnings and share diverse industry experiences. Analytic Network coaches have went on to drive high-impact organizational change. We're now accepting applications for our next cohort, which is starting in mid-February. If you'd like to join an international community of like-minded, high-level coaches that are creating real change, then fill out our application form by opening a web browser on your smartphone, tablet, or desktop computer and enter the following web address: bit.ly/ANC qualify. That's bit.ly/ANC qualify. One more time: bit.ly/ANC qualify. If you have any issues with the application process, send an email to simon@analyticnetwork.com. I hope to see you there, and now on to the show.
So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today, I'm delighted to have a special guest, Ian Parker. Ian is a member of the new revolutionary organization, Anti-Capitalist Resistance, and of the Fourth International. His academic work has always been critical of psychology and psychiatry. His most recent book, co-authored with his Mexican comrade, David Pavón Soler, is Psychoanalysis and Revolution, Critical Psychology for Liberation Movements. Ian was previously a university professor and is widely published and cited. Ian, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. It's good to be here.
Good. So, first question, I'm really interested. What has psychoanalysis got to do with revolution?
Well, psychoanalysis had a link with revolution right from the very start, actually. Many of the psychoanalysts in Hungary and Austria and Germany were either members of the socialist parties or the communist parties. We know, for example, about Wilhelm Reich. Wilhelm Reich set up the Sexpol movement and explicitly linked his communist politics with psychoanalysis. But many of the other psychoanalysts were also involved in left-wing politics as well. And that link was broken by the rise of the Nazis, where many of the psychoanalysts were put into concentration camps, and those that fled continental Europe to America and England and other parts of the world, then were in a precarious position and had to tone down their politics and in some cases completely hide it. And that's where psychoanalysis starts to become more conservative, more concerned with adapting people to society rather than encouraging them to reflect on who they are and to challenge societal norms.
Yeah, so that's a big distinction you make. You talk about it in your book about the psy professions and about psychoanalysis almost being a fit for these psy professions, for psychotherapy, for psychology, and also being turned away from its radical beginnings and becoming a place where people come to adapt to society, to conform to kind of society's needs. Is that your take on it?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly it. And what we're trying to do is to connect with that radical history of psychoanalysis and also show how that radical history is still alive in parts of the world. In Brazil, for example, there are psychoanalysts who go into the favelas and make it available as a free treatment, available to everybody, in line with what Freud argued back in 1918 in a conference in Budapest, where he argued that psychoanalysis should be available free as a treatment as part of the plans to develop a kind of version of the National Health Service in Hungary at that time, before the revolution there was rolled back. So we're connecting back to history, but also looking to practical initiatives that are being taken today by some psychoanalysts, and also by other practitioners who use psychoanalytic ideas in their work, psychotherapists and counselors. I mean, psychoanalysis is something that is in lots of places, not only in the practice of the accredited psychoanalysts. And I think we should remember that when we're talking about psychoanalysis, that we're talking about it more broadly.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I got told off a message on LinkedIn from the IPA, gave a definition of psychoanalysis, and it is very, very weak. And I put in something about psychoanalysis is a countercultural activist movement. And of course, I got told off for it. But I think for me, that's right. Psychoanalysis is always countercultural. I mean, its very stance is countercultural. And it challenges the existing status quo, the existing norms. It kind of asks questions about the unconscious, which are always problematic for those who want to keep power where it is at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think part of the problem is that the kind of psychoanalysis that is dominant in the English-speaking world is a kind of psychoanalysis that has tried to make alliances with psychology and psychiatry and has become quite normative in its practice. That is, has an idea of what is normal and tries to fit people in with that. And in that process, I think that if you look at the work of mainstream psychoanalysts, some of them aren't doing psychoanalysis at all. Some of them are on the road to cognitive behavioral therapy or other kinds of approach like that, which don't take the unconscious seriously. Whereas we see much more psychoanalysis in the work of psychotherapists and counselors. And let's remember that there's a kind of pyramid, a status hierarchy in the psy professions, where psychoanalysts like to be at the top, accrediting everyone else. Whereas, in fact, we find a lot of the most radical work among psychotherapists and counselors who are sometimes using psychoanalytic ideas. Not always. It's not absolutely necessary to be radical, but they find them useful sometimes. And that's the approach that we've been focusing on in our book.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I mean, my experience of psychoanalysis, I have a lot of colleagues in the US, and as we know, Freud was not very happy with the US, the way it took up psychoanalysis, and it very much is a kind of an ego psychology. It's a different way of approaching psychoanalysis. In your book, I noticed that you didn't actually name different psychoanalytic traditions. So do you have an opinion where Kleinian or British object relations psychoanalysis is moved more towards a cognitive behavioral kind of a sort of technical kind of way of working as opposed to a Lacanian approach? Do you have opinions about that, thoughts about that?
Well, I do work in my own practice as a Lacanian, but when we wrote the book together, me and my comrade David Pavon Cuellar, when we wrote that together, we wanted to keep it more open and to acknowledge that there are many different forms of psychoanalysis, relational psychoanalysis, object relations tradition, the Kleinian tradition that you mentioned, which also connect in different ways to radical politics. So we don't at all in any way rule out those connections. And there are many Lacanian psychoanalysts who aren't radical at all. So we want to notice how radical ideas can appear in many different traditions, different psychoanalytic traditions, and also different political traditions. Because, I mean, although, yes, I am a revolutionary Marxist, I do recognize that there's a lot of contributions to radical politics from anarchists, and of course from feminists, and more recently in the Black Lives Matter movement, from anti-colonial, anti-racist activists. So we have to have a kind of broad conception of what psychoanalysis is, and a broad conception of what radical politics is, if we really want to think about the intersection between those two domains of work.
Yeah. And yet you have a very strong view on what the unconscious is, which I think is very different to a lot of what people imagine psychoanalysis is, and even what a lot of psychotherapists and psychoanalysts think what the unconscious is. Do you want to say something about the unconscious and your position on that?
Yes, I think it's often a kind of misconception that we get in the psychology textbooks, that the unconscious is like that huge 90% of the iceberg below the surface, or the unconscious is some kind of massive storeroom hidden away inside individual heads where things bubble around waiting to get out. I think the unconscious in a psychoanalytic conception that we're developing in the book is very closely linked to social processes, that we shut away thinking about what is happening inside us, but we also, a lot of the time, had to shut out what is happening outside us. And that process of shutting things out is something that occurs for us as individuals, as we try not to think about things, but also occurs in the way that we participate in society and collaborate or collude with silences, with things that are forbidden to speak about in the cultural realm as well. So the unconscious is a kind of social phenomenon. Freud himself referred to psychology as being a social psychology, the psychology that he had in mind. And I think we need to take that seriously when we're thinking about all the different kinds of psychoanalytic phenomena that we find in clinical work. It's all as much social as it is individual. And so that's a fundamental premise of our work. Now, you find this kind of idea being elaborated in Lacanian psychoanalysis, but you also find it in group analysis, where they talk explicitly about the social unconscious. And you find hints of this in object relations theory, where they're concerned with what is happening between people, in Kleinian theory, with the discussion of projective identification, that is, in the way that my feelings are intimately linked with your responses and the way that you understand my feelings, and in relational psychoanalysis, of course. In each of these different traditions, we find a kind of edging towards the idea that the unconscious is not locked inside us as individuals, but is something that we participate in our social lives.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. I come from a psychodynamic, psychoanalytic systems approach, group relations and social dreaming. And in the social dreaming matrix in group relations, you know, it's very much that the unconscious is a social phenomena which happens kind of between people. I mean, I was interested in what Lacan said about the psyche, that the unconscious is on the surface and that it's everywhere around us, and yet we just don't see it, hence it's unconscious. I thought that was very, very helpful.
Yes.
But there is a distinction. When you talk about the social unconscious, many people jump to Jung and say, are you talking about the collective unconscious? But you're not a great fan of Jung, I believe.
No, I'm not a great fan of Jung, because it kind of leads you in a kind of weird mystical direction, which treats things as if they're universal and unchanging. You know, all of the kind of archetypes that are kind of hidden away in the collective unconscious. And we know that Jung kind of like refined this in a kind of bizarre way when he stayed at the head of the Psychotherapeutic Association in Germany after the Nazis took power, and had a different conception of different racial unconsciousnesses. And I think that's where that takes you. I think it also takes you in a bad place in clinical work, because It leads the practitioner to think that if they know what is in the collective unconscious, then they can tell their clients or patients what is going on for them. Whereas in reality, I think in psychoanalysis, our unconscious is singular. That is, although it's a social process, our relationship to it is different for each of us. And I think the process of psychoanalysis is a process in which we learn as patients to interpret ourselves what is happening for us, and not to be told by the psychoanalyst what is going on. And I think that's the trap that a lot of Jungian analysts are caught in, alongside with all the mystical stuff. So no, not happy with the collective unconscious approach of Jung at all. I think it's very, very problematic.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was surprised by your book. I did a skim read. I've not read it word by word, but I spent a few hours with it last night, and I was surprised that you were working mostly with psychoanalysis as a treatment method. I was expecting something a bit more like the Stavrakakis book on the Lacanian left, using psychoanalysis as more of a social critique. Yeah. Did you see it as a social critique as well as a treatment method?
Yes, I think it can be used as a social critique. It has lots of useful ideas to help us think critically about the nature of society. And I suppose here we take seriously a slogan from the socialist feminist movement in the late 1960s and early 1970s, which is that the personal is political. Mm-hmm. That is, that what happens at a political level has an impact on us as individuals. And the process of change is something that needs to happen between us and inside us, as well as in kind of the big macro political processes of the state and imperialism and all of that kind of thing. So there is a sense in which psychoanalysis is there as a tool for cultural critique. But I'm a little bit worried sometimes when I read books like the Stavrakakis book on the Lacanian left, which I do think is a very good book. Yeah. But actually, he can't find many examples of Lacanian left theorists. And one of the main theorists that he discusses in the book, that is Cornelius Castoriadis, is not Lacanian at all. And when he discusses Slavoj Žižek, he has a lot of bones to pick with Žižek, again, quite rightly. I mean, I think really, we would have to say that the main phenomenon in the world at the moment is the Lacanian right rather than the Lacanian left. So that's a big problem that we have to grapple with. I think another problem is that psychoanalysis can sometimes be taken up and used as an alternative to radical politics. That is, psychoanalysts are very good at hosting people from other disciplines, from politics and sociology and architecture or whatever, in their meetings, and telling these people how psychoanalysis is useful, what psychoanalytic interpretations can be made of the practice. But they're not very good at being guests in other disciplines and at participating in other kinds of conversations. So because both David and I are politically involved, we kind of noticed this and been reminded of it by some of our Brazilian comrades, that we need to learn how to speak in the language and with the concepts of those that we're working with. And in this book, I suppose we're trying to speak in the language and the concepts of the liberation movements so that what we say about society is understandable to them rather than kind of wading in and telling them what they don't understand and trying to replace their analysis with some kind of psychoanalytic kind of jargon.
Yeah, I mean, a few thoughts arise. One thing psychoanalysis has in common with revolutionary movements is splittism. So from Freud onwards, there's always splits in psychoanalytic groups and movements, and likewise in Marxist movements. Do you want to reflect on that at all? What's going on there?
Well, I mean, Freud had this lovely phrase about the narcissism of minor differences. And it's a phrase that I've heard quoted many times by people who learn about psychoanalysis who are involved in the left. I mean, we're specialists, really, in the left, in dividing ourselves from each other, and especially when we seize on differences of approach, which are very minimal, and set up our own groups and all of that kind of thing. Yes, there's a real problem there in splitting. But at the same time, just let's step aside from this for a moment and look at the other side of it, which is that splitting is a necessary part of any kind of dialectical activity, that there's always a danger, both in the left and in psychoanalytic approaches, to try and homogenize things, to treat whole categories of people as being the same as each other. All neurotics are like this and all hysterics are like that. Or to develop models of cultural competence where they say, well, all Arabs are like this and all Jews are like that, or all black people from the Caribbean have this kind of emotional problem, and so on and so forth. That's homogenizing is also very problematic. Back in the early days of psychoanalysis, we see it in some of the statements that Freud makes about men and women, difference between men and women, or what homosexuals are like, and so on and so forth. You see the difficulty here, that what splitting does is also something that can be useful. It's a way of introducing a division and introducing a difference that we can notice, and opening up a contradiction so that we can then have a debate. The problem is that in that debate and in that dialectical reasoning that we need to engage in to open up contradictions, in that debate, the debate often turns into a bitter argument and irreconcilable differences, where we end up on one side treating the other side as anathema. That happens in politics, of course, also happens inside the psychoanalytic organizations, which are some of the worst organizations for learning how to conduct debates.
Yeah, I agree. It's been my experience. Jacques-Alain Miller, in the Lacanian analyst in France, who was a direct colleague of Lacan's, started to do some work in social movements. Have you been following that at all?
Yes, and yes, following it with some interest and some concern. Interest because Miller was trying to develop clinics that would be more open, yeah, and draw people into a psychoanalytic frame of reference. Concern at the way that those clinics sometimes seem to be set up as a kind of gateway, a gateway to the real psychoanalysis.
Yes.
So I think there is a problem there. Also, I'm a little bit concerned about Miller's rather conservative views around sexuality and gender. There's been a significant shift in the Millerian tradition, that is, the followers of Jacqueline Miller, around sexuality and queer theory, where there's been a greater acceptance of that. But there has been a kind of pulling down of the barriers around trans. And I find some of the recent comments of Miller around trans as a kind of pathology very disturbing. In fact, it's one of the reasons that I left the Millerian organization last year.
OK. Okay. Do you think that, I mean, that's interesting. I'm very interested in queer theory and trans. For me, it's one of the, progressive is the wrong word, but it's one of the most hopeful movements in a sense that queer theory gets away from the binaries. It gets away from us being stuck in positions. It reflects much more the fluid kind of nature of humanity and what can be. Do you see it as a useful kind of or helpful way into thinking about revolutionary politics?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, a queer kind of cuts against psychoanalysis, I think, in a very productive way. In some ways, good psychoanalysis is always queer psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
Because good psychoanalysis is a kind of psychoanalysis that doesn't take for granted the division between genders that are so dominant and normative in our culture at the moment. So it kind of opens a space for people to think about their relationship to their bodies in a different way, in a way that doesn't tell you that you must be this or that because your body looks like this or that. So queer theory, it does show us how people can learn to question how they've been positioned, that is, how they've been kind of like told to be a boy or be a girl, and to open things up so that you don't have to opt for one or the other side. I mean, we know that in Freud's own work, he referred to the infant as being constitutionally bisexual, polymorphously perverse, and all of that kind of thing. And made it clear that when we learn gender roles, we are kind of layering in a certain understanding of who we are so that we then come to think of the other sex as the other sex, you know, not something that is part of us. Queer theory reminds us that our sexuality is open, diverse, and that people take different paths to being sexual beings, or in some cases, let's be honest about this, in some cases, deciding not to live their lives as sexual beings. And I think that what we have to avoid in psychoanalysis is kind of evangelism about psychoanalysis that makes it seem as if because we speak about sexuality and the importance of sexuality, that everyone else has the same take on it as kind of straight heterosexual kind of people who speak about it and worry about it and make it the center of their lives.
Yeah, I mean, I find it, psychoanalysis is both liberating in that field, you know, with Freud's early work, and you know, clearly it was written in a certain time in history and socially sort of constructed around that culture at the time, and then the Lacanian work on gender and sexuality. But there's also this tradition which is problematic that, you know, Freud, the Oedipus complex, and kind of the father was very much kind of a part of his construct, and then decline in object relations put the mother at the heart of it, the breast and the mother relationships at the kind of heart of the work. And psychoanalysis comes from kind of that way of thinking. How do you kind of work with a different way of thinking when you're actually in practice?
I think in a paradoxical way, it's where the psychoanalyst needs to know about politics and political debates around sexual and gender identity and queer theory, for example, but also this comes in their understanding of cultural debates and post-colonial theory, anti-racist theory, and so on. They need to know about that politics precisely so that they can better leave it at the clinic door and listen to what their patient is saying in a way that is open and non-judgmental. And there's nothing that will lead someone to make assumptions quicker than if they think that they already don't make any assumptions. I think this is something that we learn from any kind of progressive therapy approach and psychoanalysis, which is that our blind spots Oh, there's a phrase. The things that we think that we don't think about are precisely the ones that structure how we think. And so we need to reflect intensely on that. And that involves debating it with other people, not only thinking about it in the privacy of our consulting room, but talking about it in supervision, engaging in public debate, and being able to clarify what is the difference between all of those assumptions that we make in our everyday conversation outside the clinic. What's the difference between that and the very peculiar way that we open a space for people to speak and free associate inside the clinic, so that we don't leap in and think that we know what they're saying and think, what the guide rails should be for them to arrive at a kind of healthy, adaptive, a kind of way of being.
Yeah, I mean, I teach a coaching course for executive coaches, and I, you know, one of the things I say right at the beginning is you are not neutral, because I think a lot of the psych professions like to think that they're neutral, and yet they come with a whole kind of social construct, whole agenda behind them. It kind of the social speaks through us, the unconscious speaks through us, and we carry that into the room with us. And it's about raising that awareness, isn't it? It's about really kind of realizing that we're not neutral. We bring our subjectivity into the room with us. And then the question is kind of what we do with it.
Yeah, I think it happens in at least two ways. One way is where we try just to be neutral and not have any opinions about anything. And the other comes in some of the forms of cultural competence training, which leads people to imagine that they know what different cultures experience in their lives, and to make assumptions about what different kinds of pathology will be dominant for different kinds of clients. Same happens, of course, back in the deep history of psychoanalysis, in the assumptions made about the way that men and women relate to their sexuality, relate to their internal lives. So that kind of competence training leads us to a weird kind of normative, adaptive kind of neutral stance, where we think that it's objective knowledge, whereas in fact it's infused with all kinds of political assumptions.
When I read your book and I heard you on a different podcast talking about your stance in the clinic, you talk about you don't make interpretations, the psychoanalyst doesn't make interpretations, the patient or the client make their own, they interpret their own words. And it took me back to my formative training as a counselor, psychotherapist counselor, and Carl Rogers. And I wondered how you differentiate what you do in the work to what Carl Rogers does, who's talked about non-directive work, about very careful, active listening, attentive listening, about empathy. What is different about kind of your approach to psychoanalysis, which differs from that approach?
There are some connections. I know this will be heresy to some Lacanians, but I think there are some connections with the way that we approach our practice, that is, not making judgmental comments, not guiding the patient around a certain path. And we prefer the term analysand. Analysand is the person who does the analysis. It's not the analyst who does the analyzing, but it's the analysand who does the analyzing. So I'll refer from now on to analysands when I'm talking about patients or clients or that kind of thing. I think one of the differences is that the analyst is someone who is noticing the repetition and hesitations and organization of the speech and drawing attention to the language, so that the analysand can then reflect on those processes. So it's not a question of giving unconditional positive regards to someone, whatever they say, but encouraging them to be intensely skeptical and critical about what they say, That is to take an analytic position in relation to their own account. That is to step back and think about what this language is doing to them. Language isn't only something that we use to express our inner states, but language carries with it a kind of grid of understanding that we reproduce as we speak to others, including in the clinic. And the clinic is the space where we can speak, work our way through that grid of understanding, and take a distance from it. And so the analyst is someone who helps us to notice how that grid is working.
Now, that's very helpful. I want to follow up with this, though, and try and dig a bit deeper. My understanding of Lacanian analysis, and I undertook psychoanalysis. I actually went to Paris for a while and had analysis with Jacques-Alain Miller for a bit. What I understood was that you go to analysis initially, you pay your buck and you choose somebody because you desire a master. You want some expert, you want some help with something, and then you work through a process where the analyst becomes what Lacan calls compost or waste and is no longer needed because the person arrives at the position of what you're describing now.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, absolutely. And my experience of being an analyst is not that I end the analysis as being some kind of exalted figure who has been able to provide these wonderful interpretations, but precisely that the analysand has learned to analyze for themselves and treats me as being pretty redundant at the end of the process. And I think that's the way it should be. Analysis should be something that helps you to let go of the analysis, not to remain stuck in it. And I think one of the tragedies of psychoanalysis in the academic world is often that people are stuck in a kind of psychoanalytic language and they can't let go of it. They can't take a distance from it. They need to be able to step aside from it and to view psychoanalysis itself as a kind of discourse, itself as a kind of practice, and to be able to be as skeptical about that as they are about anything else. And so what you've described there, I think, is very nice. And I've recently seen some very good accounts by Miller, where he's been speaking to young analysts in Russia, where he gives a very, very clear account of this process, of the role of the analysand as the one who is analyzing. Very much in tune with what psychoanalysis should be, I think. Psychoanalysis in its most radical, liberating aspect. Yeah.
We're coming towards an end. This has been a fascinating conversation, Ian. So thank you very much. Lacan famously addressed the revolutionaries of 1968 by saying, what you aspire to as revolutionaries is a new master. You will get one. How do you respond to that with Psychoanalysis and Revolution as the title of your book?
I'd say undoubtedly it's sometimes true that that's the case, that people go into revolutionary politics with personal agendas and unresolved stuff of their own, and look to the revolution as leading to some kind of ideal world where all contradiction will be resolved, where everyone will live happily ever after. Ever laughter as well. But that things will be solved for them personally, as well as for everyone else socially. And in the process, they're neglecting the way in which they set up the idea of revolution as being some kind of master idea that they submit themselves to. So there's something true in Lacan's comment there. But I think we should also be aware that Lacan, and he said this himself, Lacan was not a man of the left. Lacan appealed to anyone who would listen to him, sent his book, his writings, his écrit, to the head of the Communist Party in France, not one of the most progressive parties, I would say, speaking as a revolutionary. as a Trotskyist, but also tried to get an audience with the Pope, was in some ways a very conservative figure, very conservative, arrogant, domineering figure, exactly the kind of master that he warned people against. So I think we need to go back and look at all of the other ways in which psychoanalysts from different traditions have tried to find other paths to think about the relationship between psychoanalysis and politics, not to be stuck with Lacan. I'm a Lacanian, but I'm not always a Lacanian. And in most of my work as a Marxist, I'm not Lacanian at all.
And you've written quite extensively about Zizek. You've commented on his work, and he recently said, now is a time to interpret the world, not to change it, thinking taking on Marx's words and reversing them. What's your kind of thinking around Zizek and what he contributes to this kind of work?
I have very mixed feelings about Zizek. I think that this kind of comment about interpreting instead of changing is a provocation. Mm-hmm. Like much of his best work, it's a provocation. It gets us to think. Yeah. And he's had a very productive effect inside the academic world, drawing people not only to psychoanalytic ideas, but actually drawing them to Marxist ideas, to the range of ideas that there are in Marxism. Overall, I would say his intervention has been very productive, constructive, and radical. And if he makes us challenge him and oppose him and say, no, we've got to change things, then that's all for the good. That's fine. He's a quirky guy. He offers something new. He certainly helped me think in a different way about the relationship between Marxism and psychoanalysis. And I admire him for that and thank him for that. Maybe I'll... We take a phrase from Zizek in our manifesto. We take a phrase that Zizek himself borrows from Wilhelm Reich, which is that in present-day society, psychoanalysis is necessary but impossible, and we need to look forward to a time in the future where psychoanalysis will be possible but unnecessary. So, we borrow this motif from him, so he's useful in many different ways.
Yeah, no, I agree. He introduced me into Lacanian psychoanalysis from the object relation tradition, and making those links to kind of politics was very, very useful for my work and my thinking. So I feel the same. We're coming to an end, Ian. I finished the podcast by asking guests a question about what they think can help our audience live a good life and create the good society. This is all about your work, I think.
Except. I have absolutely no idea how people should live a good life. I don't live a very good life myself. But I think, if we're going to do something to save this world from utter catastrophe, from burning, from social divisions that are leading to mass murder and misery for many people, then I think that we've got to be able to struggle to create something different. And that the process of that creation, I hope, will lead to something better, better than the world we live in at the moment. It's not going to be perfect, and it's not ever going to be good for everybody. And what we think is good for us is going to be very different for you. We've got to find a way of living together in a world where we're more open and tolerant about what the good is for different people and how they live their lives and make their choices. That is kind of not possible at the moment. And it's one of the kind of ironies of history is that communism in the Soviet Union and China is presented as being somewhere, something where everyone is the same and everyone, that individuality is not tolerated. Whereas in fact, it's in this awful capitalist system that commodifies everything, that turns things into objects to be bought and sold, that introduces the most conformity. And so let's think about how we can redefine what is good and open up the question of what is good as a debate rather than something that is fixed and imposed and then sold to people.
Thank you very much, Ian Parker, for your edgy ideas. Really enjoyed talking to you. Take care.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. We'd also like to thank our sponsoring organization, the Eco Leadership Institute. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more about related events, our coach and leadership training, or our webinars, contact Simon at analyticnetwork.com or go to www.eco-leadership.institute. Thank you for listening.